Side 21. The Bachman Books, four early novels. Continuing with The Running Man on page 651. Richards boomed. That may go over in Shaker Heights, little man. In the streets, you can buy Dynacor every two blocks if you've got cash on the line. And I did. Games Federation money. You have 86 minutes. No deal. McCone?
Yes.
I'm sending the woman out now. She's seen the Irish. Amelia was looking at him with stunned horror. Meanwhile, you better get it in gear. 85 minutes. I'm not bluffing, asshole. One bullet and we're all going to the moon.
No,
she whispered. Her face was an unbelieving rictus.
You can't believe I'm going to lie for you.
If you don't, I'm dead. I'm shot and broken and hardly conscious enough to know what I'm saying. But I know this is the best way, one way or the other. Now listen, Dynacor is white and solid, slightly greasy to the touch.
No.
She clapped her hands over her ears. It looks like a bar of ivory soap. Very dense, though. Now I'm going to describe the imploder ring. It looks...
She began to weep.
I can't. You know that? I have my duty as a citizen. My conscience. I have my... Yeah, and they might find out you lied, he added dryly. Except they won't. Because if you back me, they'll cave in. I'll be off like a big-ass bird.
I can't.
Richards, send the woman out. The imploder ring is gold, he continued, about 2 inches in diameter. It looks like a key ring with no keys in it. Attached to it is a slim rod like a mechanical pencil with a G8 trigger device attached to it. The trigger device looks like the eraser on the pencil. She was rocking back and forth, moaning a little. She had a cheek in either hand and was twisting her flesh as if it were dough. I told them I had pulled out the half cock. That means you would be able to see a single small notch just above the surface of the Irish. Got it? No answer. She wept and moaned and rocked. Sure you do, he said softly. You're a bright girl, aren't you? I'm not going to lie, she said. If they ask you anything else, you don't know from Rooty Toot. You didn't see. You were too scared. Except for one thing. I've been holding the ring ever since that first roadblock. You didn't know what it was, but I had it in my hand.
Better kill me now.
Go on, he said. Get out. She stared at him convulsively, her mouth working, her eyes dark holes. The pretty, self-assured woman with the wraparound shades was all gone. Richards wondered if that woman would ever reappear. He did not think so, not wholly. Go, he said. Go, go.
Oh, God.
She lunged against the door and half sprang, half fell out. She was on her feet instantly and running. Her hair streamed out behind her, and she seemed very beautiful, almost goddess-like, and she ran into the lukewarm starburst of a million flashbulbs. Carbines flashed up, ready, and were lowered as the crowd ate her. Richards risked cocking an eyebrow over the driver's side window, but could see nothing. He slouched back down, glanced at his watch, and waited for dissolution. -033, and counting. The red second hand on his watch made two circles. Another two. Another two. Richards! He raised the bullhorn to his lips. 79 minutes, McCone.
Play it right up to the end.
The only way to play it. Right up to the moment McCone gave the order to fire at will. It would be quick, and it didn't really seem to matter a whole hell of a lot. After a long, grudging, eternal pause, we need more time. At least 3 hours. There isn't an LGA or a Delta on this field. One will have to be flown in. She had done it. Oh, amazing grace. The woman had looked into the abyss and then walked out across it. No net, no way back. Amazing. Of course, they didn't believe her. It was their business not to believe anyone about anything. Right now, they would be hustling her to a private room in one of the terminals, half a dozen of McCone's picked interrogators waiting. And when they got her there, the litany would begin. Of course, you're upset, Mrs. Williams, but just for the record,
Would you mind going through this once more?
We're puzzled by one small thing here. Are you sure that wasn't the other way around?
How do you know?
Why?
Then what did he say?
So the correct move was to buy time. Fob Richards off with one excuse and then another. There's a fueling problem. We need more time. No crew is on the jetport grounds. We need more time. There's a flying saucer over runway 07. We need more time. And we haven't broken her yet. Haven't quite gotten her to admit that your high explosive consists of an alligator handbag stuffed with assorted Kleenex and change and cosmetics and credit cards. We need more time. We can't take a chance on killing you yet. We need more time. Richards, listen to me, he megaphoned back. You have 75 minutes, then it all goes up. No reply. Spectators had begun to creep back in spite of Armageddon's shadow. Their eyes were wide and wet and sexual. A number of portable spotlights had been requisitioned and focused on the little car, bathing it in a depthless glow and emphasizing the shattered windshield. Richards tried to imagine the little room where they would be holding her, probing her for the truth, and could not. The press would be excluded, of course. McCone's men would be trying to scare the tits off her and undoubtedly would be succeeding. But how far would they dare go with a woman who did not belong to the ghetto society of the poor, where people had no faces? Drugs. There were drugs, Richards knew. Drugs that McCone could command immediately. Drugs that could make a Yaqui Indian babble out his entire life story like a babe in arms. Drugs that would make a priest rattle off penitents' confessions like a stenographer's recording machine. A little violence? The modified electric move-alongs that had worked so well in the Seattle riots of 2005? Or only the steady battering of their questions? The thoughts served no purpose. But he could not shut them out or turn them off. Beyond the terminals, there was the unmistakable whine of a Lockheed carrier being warmed up. His bird. The sound of it came in rising and falling cycles. When it cut off suddenly, he knew the fueling had begun. 20 minutes if they were hurrying. Richards did not think they would be hurrying. Well, 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 here we are. All the cards on the table but one. McCone? McCone, are you peeking yet? Have you sliced into her mind yet? Shadows lengthened across the field, and everybody waited. -032, and counting. Richards discovered that the old cliché was a lie. Time did not stand still. In some ways, it would have been better if it had. Then there at least would have been an end to hope. Twice the amplified voice informed Richards that he was lying. He told them if it was so, they had better open up. 5 minutes later, a new amplified voice told him that the Lockheed's flaps were frozen and that fueling would have to begin with another plane. Richards told them that was fine, as long as the plane was ready to go by the original deadline. The minutes crept by. 26 left. 25. 22. 20. She hadn't broken yet. My God, maybe... 18. 15. The plane's engines again, rising to a strident howl as the ground crews went through fuel system and pre-flight checks. 10 minutes, then 8. Richards? Here. We have simply got to have more time. The bird's flaps are frozen solid. We're going to irrigate the veins with liquid hydrogen, but we simply have to have time. You have it. 7 minutes. Then I am going to proceed to the airfield using the service ramp. I will be driving with one hand on the wheel and one hand on the imploder ring. All gates will be opened. And remember that I'll be getting closer to those fuel tanks all the time. You don't seem to realize that we... I'm through talking, fellows. 6 minutes. The second hand made its orderly, regular turns. 3 minutes left. 2. 1. They would be going for broke. In the little room he could not imagine. He tried to call Amelia's image up in his mind and failed. It was already blurring into other faces. One composite face composed of Stacy and Bradley and Elton and Virginia Paracus and the boy with the dog. All he could remember was that she was soft and pretty in the uninspired way that so many women can be, thanks to Max Factor and Revlon and the plastic surgeons who tuck and tie and smooth out and unbend. Soft, soft, but hard in some deep place. Where did you go hard, wasp woman? Are you hard enough? Or are you blowing the game right now? He felt something warm running down his chin and discovered he had bitten his lips through, not once, but several times. He wiped his mouth absently, leaving a teardrop-shaped smear of blood on his sleeve, and dropped the car into gear. It rose obediently, lifters grumbling. Richards, if you move that car, we'll shoot. The girl talked. We know. No one fired a shot. In a way, it was almost anticlimactic.
-031 and counting. The service ramp described a rising arc around the glassine, futuristic Northern States terminal. The way was lined with police holding everything from mace B and tear gas to heavy armor-piercing weaponry. Their faces were flat, dull, uniform. Richards drove slowly, sitting up straight now, and they looked at him with vacant, bovine awe. In much the same way, Richards thought, that cows must look at a farmer who had gone mad and lies kicking and sunfishing and screaming on the barn floor. The gate to the service area, caution, employees only, no smoking, unauthorized persons keep out, had been swung open, and Richards drove sedately through, passing ranks of high-octane tanker trucks and small private planes pulled up on their chocks. Beyond them was a taxiway. Wide, oil-blackened cement with expansion joints. Here his bird was waiting, a huge white jumbo jet with a dozen turbine engines softly grumbling. Beyond, runways stretched straight and clean into the gathering twilight, seeming to approach a meeting point on the horizon. The bird's roll-up stairway was just being put into place by four men wearing coveralls. To Richards, it looked like the stairs leading to a scaffold. And, as if to complete the image, the executioner stepped neatly out of the shadows that the plane's huge belly threw. Evan McCone. Richards looked at him with the curiosity of a man seeing a celebrity for the first time. No matter how many times you see his picture in the movie 3Ds, you can't believe his reality until he appears in the flesh. And then the reality takes on a curious tone of hallucination, as if entity had no right to exist separate from image. He was a small man, wearing rimless glasses, with a faint suggestion of a pot belly beneath his well-tailored suit. It was rumored that McCone wore elevator shoes, but if so, they were unobtrusive. There was a small silver flag pin in his lapel. All in all, he did not look like a monster at all, the inheritor of such fearsome alphabet soup bureaus as the FBI and the CIA. Not like a man who had mastered the technique of the black car in the night, the rubber club, a sly question about relatives back home. Not like a man who had mastered the entire spectrum of fear. Ben Richards? He used no bullhorn, and without it, his voice was soft and cultured, without being effeminate in the slightest. Yes. I have a sworn bill from the Games Federation, an accredited arm of the Network Communications Commission, for your apprehension and execution. Will you honor it? Does a hen need a flag? Ah, McCone sounded pleased. The formalities are taken care of. I believe in formalities, don't you? No, of course you don't. You've been a very informal contestant. That's why you're still alive. Did you know you surpassed the standing running man record of 8 days and 5 hours some 2 hours ago? Of course you don't. But you have. Yes. And your escape from the YMCA in Boston. Sterling. I understand the Nielsen rating on the program jumped 12 points. Wonderful. Of course, we almost had you during that Portland interlude. Bad luck. Paracas swore with his dying breath that you had jumped ship in Auburn. We believed him. He was so obviously a frightened little man. Obviously, Richards echoed softly. But this last play has been simply brilliant. I salute you. In a way, I'm almost sorry the game has to end. I suspect I shall never run up against a more inventive opponent. Too bad, Richards said. It's over, you know, McCone said. The woman broke. We used sodium pentothal on her, old but reliable. He pulled a small automatic. Step out, Mr. Richards. I will pay you the ultimate compliment. I'm going to do it right here, where no one can film it.
Your death will be one of relative privacy. Get ready, then. Richards grinned. He opened the door and stepped out. The two men faced each other across the blank service area cement. -030 and counting. It was McCone who broke the deadlock first. He threw back his head and laughed. It was a very cultured laugh, soft and velvet. Oh, you are so good, Mr. Richards, par excellence. Raise, call, and raise again. I salute you with honesty. The woman has not broken. She maintains stubbornly that the bulge I see in your pocket there is Black Irish. We can't SAP her because it leaves a definable trace. A single EEG on the woman, and our secret would be out. We are in the process of lifting in 3 ampules of Canagan from New York. Leaves no trace. We expect it in 40 minutes. Not in time to stop you, alas. She is lying, it's obvious. If you will pardon a touch of what your fellows like to call elitism, I will offer my observation that the middle class lies well only about sex. May I offer another observation? Of course I may. I am. McCone smiled. I suspect it's her handbag. We noticed she had none, although she had been shopping. We're quite observant. What happened to her purse if it isn't in your pocket, Richards? He would not pick up the gambit. Shoot me if you're so sure. McCone spread his hands sorrowfully. How well I'd love to. But one does not take chances with human life, not even when the odds are 50-1 in your favor. Too much like Russian roulette. Human life has a certain sacred quality. The government, our government, realizes this. We are humane. Yes, yes, Richard said and smiled feralely. McCone blinked. So you see? Richard started. The man was hypnotizing him. The minutes were flying. A helicopter was coming up from Boston loaded with 3 ampules of Jack Me Up and Turn Me Over. And if McCone said 40 minutes, he meant 20. And here he stood listening to this man's tinkling little anthem. God, he was a monster. Listen to me, Richard said harshly, interrupting. The speech is short, little man. When you inject her, she's going to sing the same tune. For the record, it's all here. Dig? He locked his gaze with McCone's and began to walk forward. I'll see you, shit-eater. McCone stepped aside. Richards didn't even bother to look at him as he passed. Their coat sleeves brushed. For the record, I was told the pull on half-cock was about 3 pounds. I've got about 2.5 on now, give or take. He had the satisfaction of hearing the man's breath whistle a little faster. Richards? He looked back from the stairs, and McCone was looking up at him, the gold edges of his glasses gleaming and flashing. When you get in the air, we're going to shoot you down with a ground-to-air missile. The story for the public will be that Richards got a little itchy on the trigger. R.I.P. You won't, though. No? Richards began to smile and gave half a reason. We're going to be very low and over heavily populated areas. Add 12 fuel pods to 12 pounds of Irish and you got a very big bang potential. Too big. You'd do it if you could get away with it, but you can't. He paused. You're so bright. Did you anticipate me on the parachute? Oh, yes, McCone said calmly. It's in the forward passenger compartment. Such old hat, Mr. Richards. Or do you have another trick in your bag?
All right.
You haven't been stupid enough to tamper with the chute either, I'll bet. Oh, no, too obvious. And you would pull that non-existent imploder ring just before you struck, I imagine. Quite an effective airburst. Goodbye, little man. Goodbye, Mr. Richards, and bon voyage, he chuckled. Yes, you do rate honesty. So I will show you one more card, just one. We are going to wait for the Canagan before taking action. You are absolutely right about the missile. For now, just a bluff. Call and raise again, eh? But I can afford to wait. You see, I am never wrong. Never. And I know you are bluffing. So we can afford to wait. But I'm keeping you. Voir, Mr. Richards, he waved. Soon, Richards said, but not loud enough for McCone to hear, and he grinned. -029, and counting. The first-class compartment was long and 3 aisles wide, paneled with real aged sequoia. A wine-colored rug, which felt yards deep, covered the floor. A 3D movie screen was cranked up and out of the way on the far wall between the first class and the galley. In seat 100, the bulky parachute pack sat. Richards patted it briefly and went through the galley. Someone had even put coffee on. He stepped through another door and stood in a short throat which led to the pilot's compartment. To the right, the radio operator, a man of perhaps 30 with a care-lined face, looked at Richards bitterly and then back at his instruments. A few steps up and to the left, the navigator sat at his boards and grids and plastic-encased charts. "The fellow who's going to get us all killed is coming up, fellas," he said into his throat mic. He gazed coolly at Richards. Richards said nothing. The man, after all, was almost certainly right. He limped into the nose of the plane. The pilot was 50 or better, an old war horse with the red nose of a steady drinker and the clear, perceptive eyes of a man who was not even close to the alcoholic edge. His co-pilot was 10 years younger, with a luxuriant growth of red hair spilling out from under his cap. "Hello, Mr. Richards," the pilot said. He glanced at the bulge in Richards' pocket before he looked at his face. "Pardon me if I don't shake hands. I'm Flight Captain Don Holloway. This is my co-pilot, Wayne Dunninger." "Under the circumstances, not very pleased to meet you," Dunninger said. Richards' mouth quirked. "In the same spirit, let me add that I'm sorry to be here. Captain Holloway, you're patched into communications with McCone, aren't you?" "We sure are, through Kippy Friedman, our communications man. Give me something to talk into." Holloway handed him a microphone with infinite carefulness. "Get going on your pre-flight," Richard said. 5 minutes. "Will you want the explosive bolts on the rear loading door armed?" Dunninger said with great eagerness. "Tend your knitting," Richard said coldly. It was time to finish it off, make the final bet. His brain felt hot, overheated, on the verge of blowing a bearing. Call and raise, that was the game. "I'm going to sky's the limit right now, McCone." "Mr. Friedman?"
"Yes?"
"This is Richards. I want to talk to McCone." Dead air for half a minute. Holloway and Dunninger weren't watching him anymore. They were going through pre-flight, reading gauges and pressures, checking flaps, doors, switches. The rising and falling of the huge GA turbines began again, but now much louder, strident. When McCone's voice finally came, it was small against the brute noise. "McCone here. Come on, Maggot. You and the woman are going for a ride. Show up at the loading door in 3 minutes, or I pull the ring." Dunninger stiffened in his bucket seat as if he had been shot. When he went back to his numbers, his voice was shaken and terrified. "If he's got guts, this is where he calls. Asking for the woman gives it away. If he's got guts." Richards waited. A clock was ticking in his head. -028 and counting. When McCone's voice came, it contained a foreign, blustery note. Fear? Possibly. Richards' heart lurched in his chest. Maybe it was all going to fall together. Maybe. "You're nuts, Richards. I'm not..." "You listen," Richards said, punching through McCone's voice. "And while you are, remember that this conversation is being party-lined by every ham operator within 60 miles. The word is going to get around. You're not working in the dark, little man. You're right out on the big stage. You're coming because you're too chicken shit to pull a double cross when you know it will get you dead. The woman's coming because I told her where I was going." Weak. Punch him harder. Don't let him think. "Even if you should live when I pull the ring, you won't be able to get a job selling apples." He was clutching the handbag in his pocket with frantic, maniacal tightness. "So that's it. 3 minutes. Signing off." "Richards, wait!" He signed off, choking McCone's voice. He handed the mic back to Holloway, and Holloway took it with fingers that trembled only slightly. "You've got guts," Holloway said slowly. "I'll say that. I don't think I ever saw so much guts." "There will be more guts than anyone ever saw if he pulls that ring," Dunninger said. "Continue with your pre-flight, please," Richards said. "I'm going back to welcome our guests. We go in 5 minutes." He went back and pushed the chute over to the window seat, then sat down watching the door between first class and second class. He would know very soon. He would know very soon. His hands worked with steady, helpless restlessness on Amelia Williams' handbag. Outside, it was almost full dark. -027 and counting. They came up the stairs with a full 45 seconds to spare. Amelia was panting and frightened, her hair blown into a haphazard beehive by the steady wind that rolled this man-made flatland. McCone's appearance was outwardly unchanged. He remained neat and unaffected, unruffled, you might say, but his eyes were dark with a hate that was nearly psychotic.
"You haven't won a thing, Maggot," he said quietly. "We haven't even started to play our trump cards yet."
"It's nice to see you again, Mrs. Williams," Richard said mildly. As if he had given her a signal, pulled an invisible string, she began to weep. It was not a hysterical weeping. It was an entirely hopeless sound that came from her belly like hunks of slag. The force of it made her stagger, then crumple to the plush carpet of this plush first-class section, with her face cupped in her hands, as if to hold it on. Richards's blood had dried to a tacky maroon smear on her blouse. Her full skirt, spread around her and hiding her legs, made her look like a wilted flower. Richards felt sorry for her. It was a shallow emotion, feeling sorry, but the best he could manage. "Mr. Richards," it was Holloway's voice over the cabin intercom. "Yes. Are we green?" "Yes." "Then I'm giving the service crew the order to remove the stairs and seal us up. Don't get nervous with that thing." "All right, Captain. Thank you." "You gave yourself away when you asked for the woman. You know that, don't you?" McCone seemed to be smiling and scowling at the same time. The overall effect was frighteningly paranoid. His hands were clenching and unclenching. "Ah, so?" Richard said mildly. "And since you're never wrong, you'll undoubtedly jump me before we take off. That way you'll be out of jeopardy and come up smelling like a rose, right?" McCone's lips parted in a tiny snarl, and then pressed together until they went white. He made no move. The plane began to pick up a tiny vibration as the engine cycled higher and higher. The noise was suddenly muted as the boarding door in second class was slammed shut. Leaning over slightly to peer out one of the circular windows on the port side, Richards could see the crew trundling away the stairs. "Now we're all on the scaffold," he thought. Minus 026 and counting. The fastened seatbelts, no smoking sign to the right of the trundled-up movie screen flashed on. The airplane began a slow, ponderous turn beneath them. Richards had gained all his knowledge of jets from the freebie and from reading, much of it lurid adventure fiction, but this was only the second time he had ever been on one, and it made the shuttle from Harding to New York look like a bathtub toy. He found the huge motion beneath his feet disturbing. "Amelia?" She looked up slowly, her face ravaged and tear-streaked. "Huh?" Her voice was rusty, dazed, mucus-clogged, as if she had forgotten where she was. "Come forward. We're taking off." He looked at McCone. "You go wherever you please, little man. You have the run of the ship. Just don't bother the crew." McCone said nothing and sat down near the curtain divider between first and second class. Then, apparently thinking better of it, he pushed through into the next section and was gone. Richards walked with the woman, using the high backs of the seats for support. "I'd like the window seat," he said. "I've only flown once before." He tried to smile, but she only looked at him dumbly. He slid in, and she sat next to him. She buckled his belt for him, so his hand did not have to come out of his pocket. "You're like a bad dream," she said. "One that never ends." "I'm sorry." "I didn't..." She began, and he clamped a hand over her mouth and shook his head. He mouthed the word "no" at her eyes. The plane swung around with slow, infinite care, turbines screaming, and began to trundle toward the runways like an ungainly duck about to enter the water. It was so big that Richards felt as if the plane were standing still and the earth itself was moving. "Maybe it's all illusion," he thought wildly. "Maybe they've rigged 3D projectors outside all the windows and..." He cut the thought off. Now they had reached the end of the taxiway and the plane made a cumbersome right turn. They ran at right angles to the runways, passing 3 and 2. At 1, they turned left and paused for a second. Over the intercom, Holloway said expressionlessly, "Taking off, Mr. Richards." The plane began to move slowly at first, at no more than air car speed, and then there was a sudden terrifying burst of acceleration that made Richards want to scream aloud in terror. He was driven back into the soft pile of his seat, and the landing lights outside suddenly began to leap by with dizzying speed. The scrub bushes and exhaust-stunted trees on the desolate sunset-riven horizon roared toward them. The engines wound up and up and up. The floor began to vibrate again. He suddenly realized that Amelia Williams was holding onto his shoulder with both hands, her face twisted into a miserable grimace of fear. Dear God, she's never flown either. "We're going," he said. He found himself repeating it over and over and over, unable to stop. "We're going. We're going." "Where?" she whispered. He didn't answer. He was just beginning to know. -025 and counting. The two troopers on roadblock duty at the eastern entrance of the jetport watched the huge liner fling itself down the runway, gaining speed. Its lights blinked orange and green in the growing dark, and the howl of its engines buffeted their ears. "He's going! Christ, he's going!" "Where?" said the other. They watched the dark shape as it separated from the ground. Its engines took on a curiously flat sound, like artillery practice on a cold morning. It rose at a steep angle, as real and as tangible and as prosaic as a cube of butter on a plate, yet improbable with flight. "You think he's got it?" "Hell, I don't know." The roar of the jet was now coming to them in falling cycles. "I tell you one thing, though." The first turned from the diminishing lights and turned up his collar. "I'm glad he's got that bastard with him, that McCone. Can I ask you a personal question? As long as I don't have to answer it. Would you like to see him pull it off?" The trooper said nothing for a long time. The sound of the jet faded, 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 until it disappeared into the underground hum of nerves at work. "Yes." "Do you think he will?" A crescent smile in the darkness. "My friend, I think there's gonna be a big boom." -024 and counting. The earth had dropped away below them. Richard stared out wonderingly, unable to drink his fill. He had slept through the other flight as if in wait for this one. The sky had deepened to a shade that hung on the borderline between royal velvet and black. Stars poked through with hesitant brilliance. On the western horizon, the only remnant of the sun was a bitter orange line that illuminated the dark earth below, not at all. There was a nestle of lights below he took to be Derry. "Mr. Richards?" "Yes." He jumped in his seat as if he had been poked. "We are in a holding pattern right now. That means we are describing a large circle above the Voigt jetport. Instructions?" Richards thought carefully. It wouldn't do to give too much away. "What's the absolute lowest you can fly this thing?" There was a long pause for consultation. "We could get away with 2,000 feet, Holloway said cautiously. "It's against NSA regs, but..." "Never mind that," Richard said. "I have to put myself in your hands to a certain extent, Mr. Holloway. I know very little of flying, and I'm sure you've been briefed on that. But please remember that the people who are full of bright ideas about how to bamboozle me are all on the ground and out of danger. If you lie to me about anything and I find out..." "Nobody up here is going to do any lying," Holloway said. "We're only interested in getting this thing back down the way it went up." "Okay, good." He gave himself time to think. Amelia Williams sat rigidly beside him, her hands folded in her lap. "Go due west," he said abruptly. 2,000 feet. Point out the sights as we go along, please." "The sights?" "What we're going over," Richard said. "I've only flown once before." "Oh," Holloway sounded relieved. The plane banked beneath their feet, and the dark sunset line outside the window tilted on its ear. Richards watched, fascinated. Now it gleamed aslant the thick window, making odd fugitive sun gleams just beyond the glass. "We're chasing the sun," he thought. "Isn't that amazing?" It was 6:35. -023 and counting. The back of the seat in front of Richards was a revelation in itself. There was a pocket with a safety handbook in it. In case of air turbulence, fasten your belt. If the cabin loses pressure, pull down the air mask directly over your head. In case of engine trouble, the stewardess will give you further instructions. In case of sudden explosive death, hope you have enough dental fillings to ensure identification. There was a small freebie set into the seat panel at eye level. A metal card below it reminded the viewer that channels would come and go with a fair degree of speed. A touch-control channel selector was provided for the hungry viewer. Below and to the right of the freebie was a pad of airline stationery and a GA stylus on a chain. Richards pulled out a sheet and wrote clumsily on his knee. Odds are 99 out of 100 that you're bugged. Shoe mic or hair mic, maybe mesh transmitter on your sleeve. McCone listening and waiting for you to drop the other shoe, I bet. In a minute, have a hysterical outburst and beg me not to pull the ring. It'll make our chances better. You game? She nodded, and Richards hesitated, then wrote again. Why did you lie about it? She plucked the stylus out of his hand and held it over the paper on his knee for a moment, and then wrote. Don't know. You made me feel like a murderer. Wife. And you seemed so. The stylus paused, wavered, and then scrawled, pitiful. Richards raised his eyebrows and grinned a little. It hurt. He offered her the stylus, but she shook her head mutely. He wrote, go into your act in about 5 minutes. She nodded, and Richards crumpled the paper and stuffed it into the ashtray embedded in the armrest. He lit the paper. It puffed into flame and blazed brightly for a moment, kindling a tiny reflective glow in the window. Then it collapsed into ashes, which Richards poked thoughtfully. About 5 minutes later, Amelia Williams began to moan. It sounded so real that for a moment Richards was startled. Then it flashed across his mind that it probably was real. Please don't, she said. Please don't make that man have to try you. I never did anything to you. I want to go home to my husband. We have a daughter, too. She's 6. She'll wonder where her mommy is. Richards felt his eyebrow rise and fall twice in an involuntary tick. He didn't want her to be that good. Not that good. He's dumb, he told her, trying not to speak for an unseen audience. But I don't think he's that dumb. It will be all right, Mrs. Williams. That's easy for you to say. You've got nothing to lose. He didn't answer her. She was so patently right. Nothing, anyway, that he hadn't lost already. Show it to him, she pleaded. For God's sake, why don't you show it to him? Then he'd have to believe you. Call off the people on the ground. They're tracking us with missiles. I heard him say so. I can't show him, Richard said. To take it out of my pocket would mean putting the ring on safety or taking the full risk of blowing us up accidentally. Besides, he added, injecting mockery into his voice, I don't think I'd show him if I could. He's the maggot with something to lose. Let him sweat it. I don't think I can stand it, she said dully. I almost think I'd rather joggle you and have it over. That's the way it's going to end anyway, isn't it? You haven't, he began. And then the door between first and second was snapped open and McCone half-strode, half-lunged through. His face was calm, but beneath the calm was an odd, sheeny look which Richards recognized immediately. The sheen of fear, white and waxy and glowing. Mrs. Williams, he said briskly. Coffee, if you please, for 7. You'll have to play stewardess on this flight, I'm afraid. She got up without looking at either of them. Where? Forward, McCone said smoothly. Just follow your nose. He was a mild, blinking sort of man, and ready to lunge at Amelia Williams the moment she showed a sign of going for Richards. She made her way up the aisle without looking back. McCone stared at Richards and said, would you give this up if I could promise you amnesty, pal? Pal, that word sounds really greasy in your mouth, Richards marveled. He flexed his free hand, looked at it. The hand was caked with small runnels of dried blood, dotted with tiny scrapes and scratches from his broken ankle hike through the southern Maine woods. Really greasy. You make it sound like 2 pounds of fatty hamburger cooking in the pan. The only kind you can get at the welfare stores in Co-op City. He looked at McCone's well-concealed pot. That now, that looks more like a steak gut, prime cut. No fat on prime cut except that crinkly little ring around the outside, right? Amnesty, McCone repeated. How does that word sound? Like a lie, Richard said, smiling.
Like a fat fucking lie. Don't you think I know you're nothing but the hired help?
McCone flushed. It was not a soft flush at all. It was hard and red and brick-like.
It's going to be good to have you on my home court, he said. We've got high-impact slugs that will make your head look like a pumpkin dropped on a sidewalk from the top floor of a skyscraper. Gas-filled. They explode on contact. A gut shot, on the other hand.
Richard screamed. Here it goes! I'm pulling the ring!
McCone screeched. He staggered back two steps. His rump hit the well-padded arm of seat number 95 across the way. He overbalanced and fell into it like a man into a sling, his arms flailing the air around his head in crazed warding-off gestures. His hands froze about his head like petrified birds, splay-fingered. His face stared through their grotesque frame like a plastered death mask on which someone had hung a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles for a joke. Richards began to laugh. The noise of it was cracked at first, hesitant, foreign to his own ears. How long had it been since he had had a real laugh, an honest one, the kind that comes freely and helplessly from the deepest root of the stomach? It seemed to him that he had never had one in his whole gray, struggling, earnest life, but he was having one now.
You bastard. McCone's voice had failed him. He could only mouth the words. His face was twisted and scrunched like the face of a badly used teddy bear.
Richards laughed. He held on to one arm of his seat with his free hand and just laughed and laughed and laughed. Minus 022 and counting. When Holloway's voice informed Richards that the plane was crossing the border between Canada and the state of Vermont, Richards supposed he knew his business. He himself could see nothing but darkness below them, interrupted by occasional clusters of light. He set his coffee down carefully and said, "Could you supply me with a map of North America, Captain Holloway?" "Physical or political?" a new voice cut in. The navigator's, Richards supposed. Now he was supposed to play obligingly dumb and not know which map he wanted, which he didn't.
"Both," he said flatly. "Are you going to send the woman up for them?"
"What's your name, pal?" The hesitant pause of a man who realizes with sudden trepidation that he has been singled out.
"Donahue." "You've got legs, Donahue. Suppose you trot them back here yourself."
Donahue trotted them back. He had long hair combed back greaser fashion and pants tailored tight enough to show what looked like a bag of golf balls at the crotch. The maps were encased in limp plastic. Richards didn't know what Donahue's balls were encased in. "I didn't mean to mouth off," he said unwillingly. Richards thought he could peg him. Well-off young men with a lot of free time often spent much of it roaming the shabby pleasure areas of the big cities, roaming in well-heeled packs, sometimes on foot, more often on choppers. They were queer stompers. Queers, of course, had to be eradicated. Save our bathrooms for democracy. They rarely ventured beyond the twilight pleasure areas into the full darkness of the ghettos. When they did, they got the shit kicked out of them. Donahue shifted uneasily under Richards's long gaze. "Anything else?"
"You a queer stomper, pal?"
"Huh?"
"Never mind. Go on back. Help them fly the plane."
Donahue went back at a fast shuffle. Richards quickly discovered that the map with the towns and cities and roads was the political map. Pressing one finger down from Derry to the Canada-Vermont border in a western-reaching straight edge, he located their approximate position.
"Captain Holloway?"
"Yes."
"Turn left."
"Huh?"
Holloway sounded frankly startled.
"South, I mean. Due south. And remember..."
"I'm remembering,"
Holloway said. "Don't worry." The plane banked. McCone sat hunched in the seat he had fallen into, staring at Richards with hungry, wanting eyes. Minus 021 and counting. Richards found himself drifting in and out of a daze, and it frightened him. The steady drone of the engines were insidious, hypnotic. McCone was aware of what was happening, and his leaning posture became more and more vulpine. Amelia was also aware. She cringed miserably in a forward seat near the galley, watching them both. Richards drank two more cups of coffee. Not much help. It was becoming increasingly difficult to concentrate on the coordination of his map and Holloway's toneless commentary on their outlaw flight. Finally, he drove his fist into his side where the bullet had taken him.
The pain was immediate and intense, like a dash of cold water in the face. A whistling, half-whispered screech issued from either side of his clenched mouth like stereo. Fresh blood wet his shirt and sieved through onto his hand. Amelia moaned. "We'll be passing over Albany in about 6 minutes," Holloway said. "If you look out, you'll see it coming up on your left." "Relax," Richard said to no one, to himself. "Relax, just relax."
"God, will it be over soon?"
"Yes, quite soon." It was 7:45. Minus 020 and counting. It could have been a bad dream, a nightmare that had crawled out of the dark and into the unhealthy limelight of his half-awake mind, more properly a vision or an hallucination. His brain was working and concentrating on one level, dealing with the problem of navigation and the constant danger of McCone. On another, something black was taking place. Things were moving in the dark. Track on. Positive. Huge whining servo mechanisms turning in the dark in the night. Infrared eyes glowing in unknown spectrums. Pale green foxfire of dials and swinging radar scopes. Lock, we have a lock. Trucks rumbling along backcountry roads, and on triangulated flatbeds 200 miles apart, microwave dishes swing at the night sky. Endless streams of electrons fly out on invisible bat wings, bounce, echo. The strong blip and the fading afterimage lingering until the returning swing of light illuminates it in a slightly more southerly position. Solid? Yeah, 200 miles south of Newark. It could be Newark. Newark's on red, also southern New York. Executive hold still in effect? That's right. We had him dead bang over Albany. Be cool, pal. Trucks thundering through closed towns where people look out of cardboard-patched windows with terrified, hating eyes, roaring like prehistoric beasts in the night. Open the holes. Huge grinding motors slide huge concrete dunce caps aside, shunting them down gleaming steel tracks. Circular silos like the entrances to the underworld of the Morlocks, gasps of liquid hydrogen escaping into the air. Tracking. We are tracking, Newark. Roger, Springfield. Keep us in. Drunks sleeping in alleys wake foggily to the thunder of the passing trucks and stare mutely at the slices of sky between close-leaning buildings. Their eyes are faded and yellow. Their mouths are dripping lines. Hands pull with senile reflex for newsies to protect against the autumn cold. But the newsies are no longer there. The Freevee has killed the last of them. Freevee is king of the world. Hallelujah. Rich folks smoke dokes. The yellow eyes catch an unknown glimpse of high blinking lights in the sky. Flash, flash, red and green, red and green. The thunder of the trucks has faded, ramming back and forth in the stone canyons like the fists of vandals. The drunks sleep again. Bitchin'. We got him west of Springfield. Go, no go in 5 minutes. From Hardy? Yes. He's bracketed and braced. All across the night, the invisible bat wings fly, drawing a glittering net across the northeast corner of America. Servos, controlled by General Atomics computers, function smoothly. The missiles turn and shift subtly in 1,000 places to follow the blinking red and green lights that sketch the sky. They are like steel rattlesnakes filled with waiting venom. Richards saw it all, and functioned even as he saw it. The duality of his brain was oddly comforting in a way. It induced a detachment that was much like insanity. His blood-crusted finger followed their southward progress smoothly. Now south of Springfield, now west of Hartford, now tracking. Minus 019 and counting. Mr. Richards?
Yes.
We are over in Newark, New Jersey.
Yes, Richards said. I've been watching. Holloway? Holloway didn't reply, but Richards knew he was listening.
They've got a bead drawn on us all the way, don't they?
Yes, Holloway said. Richards looked at McCone. I imagine they're trying to decide if they can afford to do away with their professional bloodhound here. Imagine they'll decide in the affirmative. After all they have to do is train a new one.
McCone was snarling at him, but Richards thought it was a completely unconscious gesture, one that could probably be traced all the way to McCone's ancestors, the Neanderthals who have crept up behind their enemies with large rocks, rather than battling to the death in the honorable but unintelligent manner.
When do we get over open country again, Captain?
We won't, not on a due south heading. We will strike open sea after we cross the offshore North Carolina drilling derricks, though. Everything south of here is a suburb of New York City. That's about the size of it, Holloway said. Thank you. Newark was sprawled and groined below them like a handful of dirty jewelry thrown carelessly into some lady's black velvet vanity box. Captain?
Wearily.
Yes. You will now proceed due west. McCone jumped as if he had been goosed. Amelia made a surprised coughing noise in her throat. West? Holloway asked. He sounded unhappy and frightened for the first time. You're asking for it going that way. West takes us over pretty open country. Pennsylvania, between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, is all farm country. There isn't another big city east of Cleveland. Are you planning my strategy for me, Captain? No, I... Due west, Richards repeated curtly. Newark swung away beneath them.
You're crazy, McCone said.
They'll blow us apart. With you and five other innocent people on board? This honorable country?
It will be a mistake, McCone said harshly.
A mistake on purpose. Don't you watch the National Report? Richards asked, still smiling. We don't make mistakes. We haven't made a mistake since 1950. Newark was sliding away beneath the wing. Darkness took its place. You're not laughing anymore, Richards said. Minus 018 and counting. A half hour later, Holloway came on the voice comm again. He sounded excited. Richards, we've been informed by Harding Red that they want to beam a high-intensity broadcast at us from Games Federation. I was told you would find it very much worth your while to turn on the freebie. Thank you. He regarded the blank freebie screen and almost turned it on. He withdrew his hand as if the back of the next seat with its embedded screen was hot. A curious sense of dread and deja vu filled him. It was too much like going back to the beginning. Sheila, with her thin, worked face. The smell of Mrs. Jenner's cabbage cooking down the hall. The blare of the games. Treadmill to Bucks. Swim the crocodiles. Kathy's screams. There could never be another child, of course, not even if he could take all this back, withdraw it, and go back to the beginning. Even the one had been against fantastically high odds. Turn it on, McCone said. Maybe they're going to offer you a deal. Shut up, Richard said. He waited, letting the dread fill him up like heavy water. The curious sense of presentiment. He hurt very badly. His wound was still bleeding, and his legs felt weak and far away. He didn't know if he could get up to finish this charade when the time came. With a grunt, Richards leaned forward again and pushed the on button. The freebie sprang to incredibly clear, amplified signal life. The face that filled the screen, patiently waiting, was very black and very familiar. Dan Killian. He was sitting at a kidney-shaped mahogany desk with the game symbol on it. Hello there, Richard said softly. He could have fallen out of his seat when Killian straightened up, grinned, and said, Hello there yourself, Mr. Richards. Minus 017, and counting. I can't see you, Killian said, but I can hear you. The jet's voice comm is being relayed through the radio equipment in the cockpit. They tell me you're shot up. It's not as bad as it looks, Richard said. I got scratched up in the woods. Oh, yes, Killian said. The famous run through the woods. Bobby Thompson canonized it on the air just tonight. Along with your current exploit, of course. Tomorrow those woods will be full of people looking for a scrap of your shirt, or maybe even a cartridge case. That's too bad, Richard said. I saw a rabbit. You've been the greatest contestant we've ever had, Richards. Through a combination of luck and skill, you've been positively the greatest. Great enough for us to offer you a deal. What deal? Nationally televised firing squad? This plane hijack has been the most spectacular, but it's also been the dumbest. Do you know why? Because for the first time, you're not near your own people. You left them behind when you left the ground. Even the woman that's protecting you, you may think she's yours. She may even think it, but she's not. There's no one up there but us, Richards. You're a dead duck, finally. People keep telling me that, and I keep drawing breath. You've been drawing breath for the last 2 hours, strictly on Games Federation say-so. I did it, and I'm the one that finally shoved through the authorization for the deal I'm going to offer you. There was strong opposition from the old guard. This kind of thing has never been done, but I'm going through with it. You asked me who you could kill if you could go all the way to the top with a machine gun. One of them would have been me. Richards, does that surprise you? I suppose it does. I had you pegged for the house nigger. Killian threw back his head and laughed, but the laughter sounded forced. The laughter of a man playing for high stakes and laboring under a great tension. Here's the deal, Richards. Fly your plane to Harding. There will be a games limo waiting at the airport. An execution will be performed. A fake. Then you join our team. There was a startled yelp of rage from McCone. You black bastard! Amelia Williams looked stunned. Very good, Richards said. I knew you were good, but this is really great. What a fine used car salesman you would have made, Killian. Did McCone sound like I was lying? McCone is a fine actor. He did a little song and dance at the airport that could have won an Academy Award. Still, he was troubled. McCone's hustling away of Amelia for coffee when it appeared she might trip the Irish. McCone's steady, heavy antagonism. They didn't fit. Or did they? His mind began to pinwheel. Maybe you're springing this on him without his knowledge, counting on his reaction to make it look even better. Killian said, You've done your song and dance with the plastic explosive, Mr. Richards. We know that you are bluffing. But there is a button on this desk, a small red button, which is not a bluff. 20 seconds after I push it, that plane will be torn apart by surface-to-air diamond-back missiles carrying clean nuclear warheads. The Irish isn't fake either, but there was a curdled taste in his mouth. The bluff was soured. Oh, it is. You couldn't get on a Lockheed GA plane with a plastic explosive, not without tripping the alarms. There are 4 separate detectors on the plane, installed to foil hijackers. A 5th was installed in the parachute you asked for. I can tell you that the alarm lights in the Voigt Field Control Tower were watched with great interest and trepidation when you got on. The consensus was that you probably had the Irish. You have proved so resourceful all the way up the line that it seemed like a fair assumption to make. There was more than a little relief when none of those lights went on. I assume you never had the opportunity to pick any up. Maybe you never thought of it until too late. Well, doesn't matter. It makes your position worse, but... McCone was suddenly standing beside Richards. Here it goes, he said, grinning. Here is where I blow your fucking head off, donkey. He pointed his gun at Richards's temple. -016 and counting. You're dead if you do, Killian said. McCone hesitated, fell back a step, and stared at the freebie unbelievingly. His face began to twist and crumple again. His lips writhed in a silent effort to gain speech. When it finally came, it was a whisper of thwarted rage. I can take him! Right now! Right here! We'll all be safe! We'll... Wearily, Killian said, You're safe now, you goddamned fool. And Donahue could have taken him, if we wanted him taken. This man is a criminal! McCone's voice was rising. He's killed police officers, committed acts of anarchy and air piracy. He's publicly humiliated me and my department. Sit down, Killian said, and his voice was as cold as the deep space between planets. It's time you remembered who pays your salary, Mr. Chief Hunter. I'm going to the council president with this. McCone was raving now. Spittle flew from his lips. You're going to be chopping cotton when this is over, Nig. You goddamn worthless night-fighting son of a bitch. Please throw your gun on the floor, a new voice said. Richards looked around, startled. It was Donahue, the navigator, looking colder and deadlier than ever. His greased hair gleamed in the cabin's indirect lighting. He was holding a wire-stock Magnum Springston machine pistol, and it was trained on McCone. Robert S. Donahue, old-timer. Games Council Control. Throw it on the floor. Minus 015, and counting. McCone looked at him for a long second, and then the gun thumped on the heavy pile of the carpet.
I think we've heard all the rhetoric we need, Donahue said. Go back into second class and sit down like a good boy.
McCone backed up several paces, snarling futilely. He looked to Richards like a vampire in an old horror movie that had been thwarted by a cross. When he was gone, Donahue threw Richards a sardonic little salute with the barrel of his gun and smiled. He won't bother you again.
You still look like a queer stomper, Richards said evenly.
A small smile faded. Donahue stared at him with sudden empty dislike for a moment, and then went forward again. Richards turned back to the freebie screen. He found that his pulse rate had remained perfectly steady. He had no shortness of breath, no rubber legs. Death had become a normality.
Are you there, Mr. Richards? Killian asked.
Yes, I am.
The problem has been handled?
Yes.
Good. Let me get back to what I was saying.
Go ahead.
Killian sighed at his tone.
I was saying that our knowledge of your bluff makes your position worse, but makes our credibility better. Do you see why?
Yes, Richard said detachedly. It means you could have blown this bird out of the sky any time. Or you could have had Holloway set the plane down at will. McCone would have bumped me.
Exactly. Do you believe we know you are bluffing?
No, but you're better than McCone. Using your planet houseboy was a fine stroke.
Killian laughed.
Oh, Richards, you are such a peach. Such a rare, iridescent bird.
And yet again it sounded forced, tense, pressured. It came to Richards that Killian was holding information which he wanted badly not to tell.
If you really had it, you would have pulled the string when McCone put the gun to your head. You knew he was going to kill you, yet you sat there.
Richards knew it was over, knew that they knew. A smile cracked his features. Killian would appreciate that. He was a man of a sharp and sardonic turn of mind. Make them pay to see the whole card, then.
I'm not buying any of this. If you push me, everything goes bank. And you wouldn't be the man you are if you didn't spin it out to the very end. Mr. Donahue?
Yes, sir.
Donahue's cool, efficient, emotionless voice came over the voice comm and out of the freebie almost simultaneously.
Please go back and remove Mrs. Williams' pocketbook from Mr. Richards' pocket. You're not to harm him in any way.
Yes, sir.
Richards was eerily reminded of the plastipunch that had stenciled his original ID card at Games headquarters. Clitter, clitter, clitter. Donahue reappeared and walked toward Richards. His face was smooth and cold and empty. Programmed. The word leaped into Richards' mind.
Stand right there, pretty boy, Richards remarked, shifting the hand in his coat pocket slightly. The man there is safe on the ground. You're the one that's going to the moon.
He thought the steady stride might have faltered for just a second, and the eyes seemed to have winced the tiniest uncertain bit. And then he came on again. He might have been promenading on the Côte d'Azur, or approaching a gibbering homosexual cowering at the end of a blind alley. Briefly, Richards considered grabbing the parachute and fleeing. Hopeless. Flee? Where? The men's bathroom at the far end of the third class was the end of the line.
See you in hell, he said softly, and made a pulling gesture in his pocket.
This time the reaction was a little better. Donahue made a grunting noise and threw his hands up to protect his face in an instinctive gesture as old as man himself. He lowered them, still in the land of the living, looking embarrassed and very angry. Richards took Amelia Williams' pocketbook out of his muddy, torn coat pocket and threw it. It struck Donahue's chest and plopped at his feet like a dead bird. Richards' hand was slimed with sweat. Lying on his knee again, it looked strange and white and foreign. Donahue picked up the bag, looked in it perfunctorily, and handed it to Amelia. Richards felt a stupid sort of sadness at its passage.
In a way, it was like losing an old friend.
Boom, he said softly. Minus 014 and counting.
Your boy's very good, Richard said tiredly when Donahue had retreated again. I got him to flinch, but I was hoping he'd pee his pants.
He was beginning to notice an odd doubling of his vision. It came and went. He checked his side gingerly. It was clotting, reluctantly, for the second time.
What now? He asked. Do you set up cameras at the airport so everyone can watch the desperado get it?
Now the deal, Killian said softly. His face was dark, unreadable. Whatever he had been holding back was now just below the surface. Richards knew it. And suddenly he was filled with dread again. He wanted to reach out and turn the free V off, not hear it anymore. He felt his insides begin a slow and terrible quaking, an actual literal quaking. But he could not turn it off, of course not. It was, after all, free.
Get thee behind me, Satan, he said thickly.
What?
Killian looked startled.
Nothing, make your point. Killian did not speak. He looked down at his hands. He looked up again.
Richards felt an unknown chamber of his mind groan with psychic presentiment. It seemed to him that the ghosts of the poor and the nameless, of the drunks sleeping in alleys, were calling his name.
McCone is played out, Killian said softly. You know it, because you did it.
Cracked him like a soft-shelled egg.
We want you to take his place.
Richards, who thought he had passed the point of all shock, found his mouth hanging open in utter, dazed incredulity. It was a lie. Had to be.
Yet, Amelia had her purse back now.
There was no reason for them to lie or offer false illusions. He was hurt and alone. Both McCone and Donahue were armed. One bullet administered just above the left ear would put a neat end to him, with no fuss, no muss, or bother. Conclusion? Killian was telling God's truth.
You're nuts, he muttered.
No.
You're the best runner we've ever had. And the best runner knows the best places to look. Open your eyes a little and you'll see that the running man is designed for something besides pleasuring the masses and getting rid of dangerous people. Richards, the network is always in the market for fresh, new talent. We have to be.
Richards tried to speak, could say nothing. The dread was still in him, widening, heightening, thickening.
There's never been a chief hunter with a family, he finally said. You ought to know why. The possibilities for extortion?
Ben, Killian said with infinite gentleness, your wife and daughter are dead. They've been dead for over 10 days.
Minus 013, and counting. Dan Killian was talking, had been perhaps for some time, but Richards heard him only distantly, distorted by an odd echo effect in his mind. It was like being trapped in a very deep well and hearing someone call down. His mind had gone midnight dark, and the darkness served as the background for a kind of scrapbook slideshow. An old Kodak of Sheila wiggling in the halls of Trades High with a loose-leaf binder under her arm. Micro-skirts had just come back into fashion then. A freeze frame of the two of them sitting at the end of the bay pier, admission free, backs to the camera, looking out at the water, hands linked. Sepia-toned photo of a young man in an ill-fitting suit and a young woman in her mother's best dress, specially taken up, standing before a JP with a large wart on his nose. They had giggled at that wart on their wedding night. Stark, black-and-white action photo of a sweating, bare-chested man wearing a lead apron and working heavy engine gear levers in a huge vault-like underground chamber lit with arc lamps. Soft-toned color photo, soft to blur the stark, peeling surroundings, of a woman with a big belly standing at a window and looking out, ragged curtain held aside, watching for her man to come up the street. The light is a soft cat's paw on her cheek. Last picture? Another old-timey Kodak of a thin fellow holding a tiny scrap of a baby high over his head,
in a curious mixture of triumph and love, his face split by a huge winning grin. The pictures began to flash by faster and faster, whirling, not bringing any sense of grief and love and loss. Not yet, no. Bringing only a cool, Novocaine numbness. Killian assuring that the network had nothing to do with their deaths, all a horrible accident. Richards supposed he believed him, not only because the story sounded too much like a lie not to be the truth, but because Killian knew that if Richards agreed to the job offer, his first stop would be Co-op City, where a single hour on the streets would get in the straight of the matter. Prowlers, three of them. Or tricks, Richards wondered, suddenly agonized. She had sounded slightly furtive on the telephone, as if holding something back. They had been hopped up, probably. Perhaps they had made some threatening move toward Kathy, and Sheila had tried to protect her daughter. They had both died of puncture wounds. That had snapped him out of it. "Don't feed me that shit!" he screamed suddenly. Amelia flinched backward and suddenly hid her face. "What happened? Tell me what happened!" "There's nothing more I can say. Your wife was stabbed over 60 times."
"Kathy," Richard said emptily, without thought, and Killian winced.
"Ben, would you like some time to think about all this?"
"Yes. Yes, I would."
"I'm desperately, desperately sorry, pal. I swear on my mother that we had nothing to do with it. Our way would have been to set them up away from you, with visiting rights if you agreed. A man doesn't willingly work for the people who butchered his family. We know that."
"I need time to think."
"As Chief Hunter," Killian said softly, "you could get those bastards and put them down a deep hole, and a lot of others just like them."
"I want to think. Goodbye."
"Aye." Richards reached out and thumbed the freebie into blackness. He sat stone-like in his seat. His hands dangled loosely between his knees. The plane droned on into darkness. "So," he thought, "it's all come unraveled, all of it." -012 and counting. An hour passed. "The time has come," the walrus said, "to talk of many things, of sailing ships and sealing wax, and whether pigs have wings." Pictures flitted in and out of his mind. Stacy, Bradley, Elton Paracus with his baby face, a nightmare of running, lighting the newspapers in the basement of the YMCA with that last match, the gas-powered cars wheeling and screeching, the Sten gun spitting flame, Laughlin's sour voice, the pictures of those two kids, the junior Gestapo agents. Well, why not? No ties now, and certainly no morality. How could morality be an issue to a man cut loose and drifting? How wise Killian had been to see that, to show Richards with calm and gentle brutality just how alone he was. Bradley and his impassioned air pollution pitch seemed distant, unreal, unimportant. Nose filters. Yes, at one time the concept of nose filters had seemed large, very important. No longer so. "The poor you will have with you always." True. Even Richards's loins had produced a specimen for the killing machine. Eventually the poor would adapt, mutate. Their lungs would produce their own filtration system in 10,000 years or in 50,000. And they would rise up, rip out the artificial filters, and watch their owners flop and kick and drum their lives away, drowning in an atmosphere where oxygen played only a minor part. And what was futurity to Ben Richards? It was all only bitchin'. There would be a period of grief. They would expect that, provide for it. There would even be rages, moments of revolt. Abortive tries to make the knowledge of deliberate poison in the air public again? Maybe. They would take care of it. Take care of him. Anticipation of a time when he would take care of them. Instinctively, he knew he could do it. He suspected he might even have a certain genius for the job. They would help him, heal him, drugs and doctors, a change of mind. Then, peace. Contentiousness rooted out like bitterweed. He regarded the piece longingly, the way a man in the desert regards water. Amelia Williams cried steadily in her seat long after the time when all tears should have gone dry. He wondered indifferently what would become of her. She couldn't very well be returned to her husband and family in her present state. She simply was not the same lady who had pulled up to a routine stop sign with her mind all full of meals and meetings, clubs and cooking. She had shown red. He supposed there would be drugs and therapy, a patient showing off. The place where two roads diverged, a pinpointing of the reason why the wrong path had been chosen. A carnival in dark mental browns. He wanted suddenly to go to her, comfort her, tell her that she was not badly broken, that a single crisscrossing of psychic band-aids should fix her, make her even better than she had been before. Sheila. Kathy. Their names came and repeated, clanging in his mind like bells, like words repeated until they are reduced to nonsense. Say your name over 200 times and discover you are no one. Grief was impossible. He could feel only a fuzzy sense of embarrassment. They had taken him, run him slack-lunged, and he had turned out to be nothing but a horse's ass after all. He remembered a boy from his grammar school days who had stood up to give the Pledge of Allegiance and his pants had fallen down. The plane droned on and on. He sank into a three-quarter doze. Pictures came and went lazily. Whole incidents were seen without any emotional color at all. Then, a final scrapbook picture. A glossy 8x10 taken by a bored police photographer who had perhaps been chewing gum. Exhibit C, ladies and gentlemen, of the jury. One ripped and sliced small body in a blood-drenched crib. Splatters and runnels on the cheap stucco walls, and the broken Mother Goose mobile bought for a dime. A great sticky clot on the second-hand teddy bear with one eye. He snapped awake, full awake and bolt upright, with his mouth propped wide in a blabbering scream. The force expelled from his lungs was great enough to make his tongue flap like a sail. Everything in the first-class compartment was suddenly clear and plangently real, overpowering, awful. It had the grainy reality of a scare tabloid newsy clip. Laughlin being dragged out of that shed in Topeka, for instance. Everything was very real and in technicolor. Amelia screamed affrightedly in unison, cringing back in her seat with eyes as huge as cracked porcelain doorknobs, trying to cram a whole fist in her mouth. Donahue came charging through the galley, his gun out. His eyes were small, enthusiastic black beads. "What is it? What's wrong? McCone?" "No," Richard said, feeling his heart slow just enough to keep his words from sounding squeezed and desperate. "Bad dream. My little girl." "Oh." Donahue's eyes softened in counterfeit sympathy. He didn't know how to do it very well. Perhaps he would be a goon all his life. Perhaps he would learn. He turned to go. "Donahue?" Donahue turned back wearily. "Had you pretty scared, didn't I?" "No." Donahue turned away on that short word. His neck was bunched. His buttocks in his tight blue uniform were as pretty as a girl's. "I could scare you worse," Richards remarked. "I could threaten to take away your nose filter." "Exeunt, Donahue." Richards closed his eyes tiredly. The glossy 8x10 came back, opened them, closed them. No glossy 8x10. He waited, and when he was sure it was not going to come back right away, he opened his eyes and thumbed on the freebie. It popped on, and there was Killian. -011, and counting. "Richards." Killian leaned forward, making no effort to conceal his tension. "I've decided to accept," Richards said. Killian leaned back, and nothing smiled but his eyes. "I'm very glad," he said. -010, and counting. "Jesus," Richard said. He was standing in the doorway to the pilot's country. Holloway turned around. "Hi." He had been speaking to something called Detroit VOR. Dunninger was drinking coffee. The twin control consoles were untended, yet they swerved, tipped, and turned as if in response to ghost hands and feet. Dials swung, lights flashed. There seemed to be a huge and constant input and output going on, to no one at all. "Who's driving the bus?" Richards asked, fascinated.
"Otto," Dunninger said.
"Otto?"
"Otto, the automatic pilot. Get it? Shitty pun."
Dunninger suddenly smiled.
"Glad to have you on the team, fella. You may not believe this, but some of us guys were rooting for you pretty hard."
Richards nodded noncommittally. Holloway stepped into the slightly awkward breach by saying,
"Otto freaks me out, too, even after 20 years of this. But he's dead safe, sophisticated as hell. It would make one of the old ones look like, well, like an orange crate beside a Chippendale bureau."
"Is that right?" Richards was staring out into the darkness.
"Yes, you lock on POD, point of destination, and Otto takes over, aided by voice radar all the way. Makes the pilot pretty superfluous, except for takeoffs and landings, and in case of trouble."
"Is there much you can do if there's trouble?" Richards asked.
"We can pray," Holloway said. Perhaps it was meant to sound jocular, but it came out with a strange sincerity that hung in the cabin.
"Do those wheels actually steer the plane?" Richards asked.
"Only up and down," Dunninger said. "The pedals control side-side motion."
"Sounds like a kid's soapbox racer."
"A little more complicated," Holloway said. "Let's just say there are a few more buttons to push."
"What happens if Otto goes off his chump?"
"Never happens," Dunninger said with a grin. "If it did, you'd just override him. But the computer is never wrong, pal."
Richards wanted to leave, but the sight of the turning wheels, the minute, mindless adjustments of the pedals and switches, held him. Holloway and Dunninger went back to their business, obscure numbers and communications filled with static. Holloway looked back once, seemed surprised to see him still there. He grinned and pointed into the darkness.
"You'll see Harding coming up there soon."
"How long?"
"You'll be able to see the horizon glow in 5 to 6 minutes.
When Holloway turned around next, Richards was gone. He said to Dunninger, "I'll be glad when we set that guy down. He's a spook." Dunninger looked down morosely, his face bathed in the green luminescent glow of the controls.
"He didn't like Otto, you know that?"
"I know it," Holloway said.
Minus 009 and counting. Richards walked back down the narrow, hip-wide corridor. Friedman, the communications man, didn't look up. Neither did Donahue. Richards stepped through into the galley and then halted. The smell of coffee was strong and good. He poured himself a cup, added some instant creamer, and sat down in one of the stewardess's off-duty chairs. The Silex bubbled and steamed. There was a complete stock of luxury frozen dinners in the see-through freezers. The liquor cabinet was fully stocked with midget airline bottles.
A man could have a good drunk, he thought.
He sipped his coffee. It was strong and fine. The Silex bubbled.
"Here I am," he thought, and sipped.
Yes, no question about it. Here he was, just sipping. Pots and pans all neatly put away. The stainless steel sink gleaming like a chromium jewel in a formica setting. And, of course, that Silex on the hot plate, bubbling and steaming. Sheila had always wanted a Silex. "A Silex lasts," was her claim. He was weeping. There was a tiny toilet where only stewardess bottoms had squatted. The door was half ajar, and he could see it. Yes, even the blue, primly disinfected water in the bowl. Defecate in tasteful splendor at 50,000 feet. He drank his coffee and watched the Silex bubble and steam, and he wept. The weeping was very calm and completely silent, yet and his cup of coffee ended at the same time. He got up and put his cup in the stainless steel sink. He picked up the Silex, holding it by its brown plastic handle, and carefully dumped the coffee down the drain. Tiny beads of condensation clung to the thick glass. He wiped his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket and went back into the narrow corridor. He stepped into Donahue's compartment, carrying the Silex in one hand.
"Want some coffee?" Richards asked.
"No," Donahue said curtly, without looking up.
"Sure you do," Richards said,
and swung the heavy glass pot down on Donahue's bent head with all the force he could manage. -008 and counting. The effort ripped open the wound in his side for the third time, but the pot didn't break. Richards wondered if it had been fortified with something, vitamin B12, perhaps, to keep it from shattering in case of high-level turbulence. It did take a huge, amazing blot of Donahue's blood. He fell silently onto his map table. A runnel of blood ran across the plastic coating of the top one and began to drip. Roger, 5-by, C19084, a radio voice said brightly. Richards was still holding the Silex. It was matted with strands of Donahue's hair. He dropped it, but there was no clunk, carpeting even here. The glass bubble of the Silex rolled up at him, a winking, bloodshot eyeball. The glossy 8x10 of Kathy in her crib appeared unbidden, and Richards shuddered. He lifted Donahue's dead weight by the hair and rummaged inside his blue flight jacket. The gun was there. He was about to drop Donahue's head back to the map table, but paused and yanked it up even further. Donahue's mouth hung unhinged, an idiot leer. Blood dripped into it. Richards wiped blood from one nostril and stared in. There it was, tiny, very tiny, a glitter of mesh. "Acknowledge ETA C19084," the radio said. "Hey, that's you," Freeman called from across the hall. "Donahue!" Richards limped into the passage. He felt very weak. Friedman looked up. "Will you tell Donahue to get off his butt and acknowledge?" Richards shot him just above the upper lip. Teeth flew like a broken savage necklace. Hair, blood, and brains splashed a Rorschach on the wall behind the chair where a 3D fold-out girl was spreading eternal legs over a varnished mahogany bedpost. There was a muffled exclamation from the pilot's compartment, and Holloway made a desperate, doomed lunge to shut the door. Richards noticed that he had a very small scar on his forehead, shaped like a question mark. It was the kind of scar a small adventurous boy might get if he fell from a low branch while playing pilot. He shot Holloway in the belly, and Holloway made a great shocked noise. "Whoo!" His feet flipped out from under him, and he fell on his face. Dunninger was turned around in his chair, his face a slack moon. "Don't shoot me, huh?" he said. There was not enough wind in him to make it a statement. End of side 21. To continue, turn the cassette over.